I'm Brian McCreath at the Kuzovitsky Music Shed with Ken David Mazur. And Ken, thank you for taking a little time. Here we are. It's an early on a morning for us, but we're going to have a good conversation anyway. Thanks for taking a little time to come in this morning.
Oh, sure. My pleasure.
So the program that you're conducting here at Tanglewood this summer with the BSO is all Czech and begins with Martinu and then two pieces by Dvorak. So I guess what I'm curious about first is your experience with this Martinu piece, the Memorial to Lidice. It's a fairly well-known piece, maybe by some people, but doesn't come up that often on programs. And I'm curious about your impulse to include it on this program. What brings you to want to include this piece here at Tanglewood?
So I actually have not heard it live in performance, and I didn't know much about the piece. All I knew was for this Dvorak program, I really wanted to include some Martinu because I love Martinu and had a conversation with Tony Fogg about some other pieces. And because of the nature of, having Joshua Bell with Dvorak violin concerto, then wanting to do, the Eighth Symphony, it doesn't leave much room for other pieces. Of course, Martinu wrote symphonies and things like that himself. So this work was something that, I discovered for the first time, through Tony, who said, there is this piece, and immediately fell in love with it, because also this idea of how does a work that's done before this one should say major violin concerto by Dvorak, which runs over half an hour, how does it prepare this concerto? And you don't want something that is, just this big, flashy, and kind of overpowers this very powerful beginning that the concerto has in itself. And so this piece seems also just perfect in that matter. So this Martinu memorial to this town in the Czech Republic, which was obliterated, if you will, by the Nazi forces, while he was in the United States. And Martinu, for me, was important to include because he has the Tanglewood connection. He was on faculty here at Tanglewood. And, he was, I believe, in Connecticut at the time that this massacre in 1942 or 43 happened. And we all know the story of Dvorak and his relationship to the United States, and the New World Symphony. We're doing actually this entire Tanglewood summer. We'll see the 7th, 8th, and 9th symphonies performed, which I don't think we planned it that way to create this trilogy. but what we see, of course, is this relationship of sort of the trajectory of his bohemian self, and then this infusion, of the American tunes and the influence of him not being home in the New World Symphony and reminiscing, the remembrances as well as the impressions of the New World. So there is a hint of this desire to think back and hearken back to his homeland. With Martinu, who was away from home when this happened, and, for those of us who've experienced or know about how hard it is to connect and yearn for those that you love and that you want to be close to them, you want to console them, either by calling them. And of course, back then that, was more difficult to do, just to connect that way, but also to give them moral support in every way possible. And this piece that he wrote was a way of a letter of support he wrote, that wasn't even performed there. It was performed here so that people would understand what it is that's happening, that the atrocities of war from that perspective that many people didn't even know about.
Because at that time it wasn't even clear what was going on in parts of Europe.
Well, yeah, exactly. Or not all the parts, or how wide-ranging perhaps it was. And here's sort of one perspective, so personal because of where he was from, and the fact that he's at home in, at the time where he was staying in Connecticut, and you really feel this yearning and this grief And this desire to work through it, you know, also on a personal level, because he couldn't be there in person, you know, can't just fly back when you have somebody deceased in the family, you know, and, you know, for those families that we know that are going through it now, which of course is also a horrible thing for them, that how difficult that is. So we feel that pain. The piece starts with this very weighty bitonality, if you will. You know, you always have these two tonalities there that are somehow, you know, if you will, in a painting, these two dark shades that are trying to, you know, work out something and try to get to the light somehow, but it's very heavy. You know, they're being basically anchored, pulled down by this anchor, if you will. And, you know, this very C minor sound, and then, you know, this major. I just felt, I mean, from the very beginning, you're being gripped by, you're being pulled in by this image and this atmosphere. And it's something quite extraordinary. And this is what Martinu does so well. And also, what's very interesting is that, you know, we all know the Christmas tune, or many of us know the Christmas tune about Good King Wenceslas.
Yes.
And Wenceslas is the patron saint of the Czech state, you know, of Bohemia. And so, you know, but, you know, the original hymn of the patron saint of Wenceslas is in minor, and it's actually quite deep. And so I think for his purposes, and he uses this for this piece and works it in, and it's hard to tell that it's there. For people who know the tune, you know, they would have kind of recognized it camouflaged, because also the pacing of the work is so slow that it's this very heavy mass. If you know this very slow paced funeral, not even march, but funeral walk. You know that, you know, you're on as you're on the grave, you're trying to bury, you know, the many. So it's not that very happy, but you know, there is a trajectory to this program. But all I can say is that it is profound. It's beautiful. I do still think that, you know, we can identify in many ways for the meaning of the piece, and in some way it sets up also the violin concerto beautifully, because you have in Joshua Bell this protagonist, you know, the through the violin that works through you know, some extraordinary heavy matter, if you will. And then ends in this, you know, joyful dance.
Yeah, know? Yeah, yeah. And I had not even put together that idea that that Dvorak and Martinu both spent time here,
yeah,
in the United States. You know, that some of their music was generated here.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the connection of these two composers and their sort of trajectories in their lives kind of brings that music to life as well.
Yeah.
Right? Well, so when it comes to gripping the program itself with the orchestra, you know, the BSO is capable of playing anything, of practically any style. What is it that, as a conductor, you want to ask the orchestra to do when they're playing Dvorak? What is it that an orchestra does beyond kind of get the right notes in the right time and all that stuff, about the style that defines Dvorak, that really brings out the essence of that composer?
Well, you know, he is, I mean, we know Brahms, you know, remarked about Dvorak that, you know, his, you know, one of Dvorak's side themes, you know, are good enough, you know, to be a main theme for him. And also, you know, he wrote about Dvorak's cello concerto, you know, is that, well, if I knew that one could write a cello concerto like that, I would have done it years ago. So there was this great admiration, and also because Brahms, who was Dvorak's elder, you know, and he actually was on the jury that gave Dvorak the initial boost of support, right? And he introduced him, of course, to orchestras such as the Vienna Philharmonic, and gave him the first commissions. But this idea of the language that people found so admirable, and the richness in his tunes and his melodies that are so not just singable. You know, there's something that is so accessible, sincere. It seems to really come from deep down, and from a very natural place. You know, that is ruined, if you will, not artificial. And I think, that's what we love about music in general. You know, the great composers all had that richness of invention, and of also knowing when they found something, what to do with it. You know, some of us, we may find something interesting that, and recognize this is something extraordinary, but, what do you do with it? And the great composers knew exactly how to get the most out of this great material.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and then with Dvorak, it's very easy, I think, for us to enjoy being a musician, also for me as a conductor, because I feel so, there's this access point, this access of really being able to understand where he is also in his mindset, in his mood of writing each of the movements. You know, just to think about how unusual the opening of the symphony is, the Eighth Symphony in G major. That, first of all, for audiences, especially back then, you get this big announcement of one of the composers. You know, at the time, of course, Dvorak was already well known, G major. And then all you get this minor melody that starts in the cellos, in this very yearning, and already this was this throwing off. So, oh, everybody's a G major, great. Let's let's hear the big opening. and of course, in history, Beethoven was the great example of playing around with people's expectations based on what was announced and then what they first heard. And here we have it in such a very how do you put it, in a very emotional, very passionate, yearning way, which is unusual. It's not, a direct statement.
Yeah.
It's such
really
a
inward looking.
It is.
It's not extroverted.
Exactly. It's searching.
Yeah.
It's also the fact that you have a melody that is really looking. It's not hasn't found what it was looking for yet. So it's so genius that he's taking us on this journey together. Let's look for a beginning, and of course, yeah, and then we actually, so this introduction, right? This is the beginning? Are you sure? and then the flute solo comes, and then now we see, the clouds are there, and then there's a little beam of light through the flute. And then, of course, and then with the brass and everything, and then with the accelerando we get into. Our job, I think, as conductors, and for me, I see it as making sure that, first of all, we don't get in the way of letting the composers hope to surprise the audience, get in the way, get in the way of what they're creating. So first, I try to recognize, okay, what was it at the time that the expectation was, because there are so many composers who try to play around with that, mm-hmm. because the more and more we go along in the history of music, the more composers know, okay, they've already been through this, and somebody else has already done that. So what am I going to do, And in my opinion, Dvorak was in the same, in the same situation, knowing, okay, who came before and what had already been done. Brahms, as we famously know, had the weight of Beethoven, knowing, okay, if I'm going to write a symphony, I have to recognize that all these others by Beethoven have come before. So how do I play with the expectations? And, you know, with Dvorak, there is a very, he has less of this burden because he doesn't have the weight, culturally speaking, if you will, of being either German or Viennese or Austrian, you know. But, you know, close enough. But he can draw on this material that is, you know, bohemian and a little bit more exotic, if you will, than the, you know, the other Germanic Central European composers. So in that regard, bringing out the hint of the essence of what we understand of what it is. You know, I'm not bohemian, but of course, when you play Dvorak, you wish you were. And in many ways, also understanding the language, right? I love how the more I learned early on also about songs, you know, from the different languages, you know, how languages work, how cadences are different, how just the intonation of speech influences most composers, if not all, in how they construct melody, because they, in some ways, often start melodies with the breath. You know, what does our breath, you know, how would we say something to someone personally? So that comes with the breath. And so this is why, for me, starting this Eighth Symphony is so natural, because there's something, you just take a relaxed, deep breath.
Yeah.
And that's how it starts. And it's also, you know, oftentimes it, when I was singing a lot and studying and then teaching about voice, it's how you take your breath that prepares the piece, right? So if the breath will take away already the character, right? So and so I say this very relaxed way of starting, you know, and first you make sure you exhale in a relaxed way, you know, and then this is the right way to inhale for the beginning of this movement, because it's, you know.
I've seen this though with people. The BSO probably doesn't need this level of coaching, but I've seen orchestras be coached where the string players are taught to breathe this way.
Oh yes,
and they it's kind of mind blowing when you're a younger musician, because I'm a string player. What does it matter how I breathe? And then they do it, and they're really, oh
yeah,
I get it.
Well, with the BSO, certainly they don't have to be coached, because they will play what they see, and they're so extraordinary at feeling me, for better or for worse. You know, so they expose. They will expose your whatever, wherever you are, and you know, in your mood, or and immediately reflect back what it is, and then you have to catch yourself. Is that what I wanted? You know, I think in the main part, and as you mentioned, the younger generations, you know, that we also have here in Tanglewood, we always have to remind them: make sure you breathe. Because, you know, they're concerned with many things that they do for the first time, and then they hold their breath because they're overwhelmed. The brain is overwhelmed.
Yep.
No, but absolutely. So the breath is so important, and the breath is so important in Dvorak, for sure. And so for me, you know, as a conductor, that's a starting point there, of course.
You just—I'd never heard someone put it this way before. But the way that you just described how the BSO musicians will tell you, they'll reflect back to you whatever you're doing.
Yeah,
I never really heard it expressed that way. That they are so sensitive, they're so ready to take whatever you do and whatever they see on the paper and make something out of it.
Yeah.
So it brings to mind your, you know, you are at this pivot point in your career, and we will unfortunately not get to see you for a little while, because you're going to go on to a new chapter here with the Milwaukee Symphony. And this is a time to sort of certainly look ahead. I want to ask you about that, but also looking at these years you've spent with the BSO, which, if we take in the totality, is almost like your whole life, because,
because
you came here with BUTI as a teenager, and then you were a TMC fellow, and I think that if I have the stories right, that you accompanied your dad when he would come to guest conduct. You were just hanging around.
You can absolutely say that I spent my whole life here, because my my first memories were from the time when I was 5 or 6. That's the first time he came and, of course, brought us along, wanted us to have this experience.
Really?
And, very early on. So I spent probably at least 20 summers.
Yeah.
So that is, you know, throughout the course of my life. And with memories that, you know, I took back everywhere, you know, and back to Europe, everywhere I went.
Yeah.
So that were the happiest.
When you first came officially to the Boston Symphony as assistant conductor, these are positions that are generally meant to be apprenticeship type positions. They're for limited terms. They allow the orchestra to have someone here who can handle some of what needs to happen, but also who is meant to be learning on the job, really. And when you first came as assistant conductor, how would you characterize at that time what your long-term ambition was, if there was any, you know, beyond sort of just trying to keep up with the cover scores and get by every week? Was there a plan that you sort of sought out or tried to develop for your life as a conductor?
No. Maybe I should have. I mean, certainly there are a few things that you'd like to know and that will help you. You know, maybe even in terms of the elimination process of things that you might think or that you don't feel the pressure of having to do if you don't need to. But in general, I would say that I was quite open to what the opportunities would take me. And also, I was never the kind of person who would say, well, you know, I feel the entitlement, you know, once I get this done, you know, or this job done, then I should be entitled to get to this point. Mm-hmm. My father very often, and also here in Tanglewood, you know, would tell me, Ken, you know, and he would remind me all the time that when he started out early, mm-hmm. you know, in his early 20s with his first assistant job, he said he treated every position as if it was his last position. And so I pass that on to other colleagues who are in the same position now of trying to figure out, okay, well, where am I going from here?
And yeah.
It's like, focus on where you are the best you can,
okay.
You know, while at the same time, of course, you know, when you get the opportunity to guest conduct other orchestras, that's great. And we understand that when we do get the opportunity, we try to make the best of it, you know, grow musically, get the best musical result, make the orchestra sound the best it possibly can. And that's our job. And
yeah.
And we try to learn, you know, from all of that, from getting that done, from working with the great musicians, and from learning from mistakes. You know, that's the most important thing. I think we, you know, early on we make mistakes. Maybe even later on we make mistakes, but the most important is what do we learn, and, you know, do we learn the right things from it?
Yeah.
And are we willing to, you know, move on with that? So for me, coming here, I was in this position. I actually originally, and of course, oftentimes what happens is that you get more opportunities. You then have to make decisions, you know, will you maybe take on this orchestra or that, or should you perhaps maybe stay in, you know, where you are, and so on. With me, I had to make some of those decisions, but I was happy to come to Boston because I knew, you know, what kind of relationship I felt, you know, I had already, you know, with going forward with the fellowships in the past and the things that the support that I felt also from some of the players that I already knew before I even started.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, from the management here and Tony and also Ellen Heistein at the TMC, who I had known already since I was in high school.
Right,
because
right.
I was one of her interns for an organization in New York City. So, so there were many great reasons to be here. And also the structure, as we know, you know, of the assistantships or even the associate positions that I'm now finishing up here with, to have the freedom of going elsewhere,
mm-hmm.
and but being anchored in a wonderful place.
Well, and you just mentioned this transition then to associate conductor, which is something that not every assistant does. Many assistants stay for a 2-year contract or so, and then they move on to whatever their next thing is. And every once in a while, there's someone who the BSO and that conductor kind of work out that it's in their mutual interest and this was the case for you. So the transition to being associate conductor, there's a little bit more responsibility that comes with that. You're being relied on maybe a little bit more, if I kind of have the scenario correct. How much of a change was that for you?
Not that big, but you know, I mean, it's great for you. An associate also means that you've built even more of a trust relationship with mm-hmm. the orchestra, because of course the orchestra has to vote or even suggest that as a possibility. So I was very grateful that they were happy with what I was doing, but at the same time, just being ready to doing, you know, other things, like, you know, I give talks and lectures.
Yes.
And I think apparently in recent years I may have been in the position of having to fill in for many more conductors than perhaps some of my predecessors had to.
There are certain assistants and associates who during their time just the whims of fate, you know, kind of bring them to, and this has happened for you. You were called upon in the last minute on I don't know how many occasions,
but it seemed
like a lot.
and as a result, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, typically in the assistant or associate positions, you don't have to perform a subscription week every year. Mm-hmm. But I ended up performing at least one, if not two, subscriptions every year, mm-hmm. Plus concerts in Tanglewood, mm-hmm. you know. And which, of course, was fantastic. I enjoyed making music with the orchestra and in every way possible with all this. So for me, it really felt a very rich experience. And I love the orchestra and I love this organization. And of course, you know, I also got to be here and certainly wouldn't have wanted to miss the opening of the Tanglewood Learning Institute and the Lindy Center.
Yeah.
And to be actually to have had the chance to conduct at the opening on June 28th with, you know, the commissioned piece by Augusta Reed Thomas, you know, it was another highlight for me.
Yeah.
Just to know, hey, I was able to be part of this, the opening of this extraordinary new chapter also in the life of Tanglewood.
Yeah.
Was great for me. So all in all, I feel, you know, from the age of five until now, I can truly say that I'm indebted in so many ways, just musically, that I was allowed to take in music, enjoy the music, and love it first, you know, as a child, and then grow slowly in confidence that this is a life that I would want to join in professionally. Mm-hmm. And now to be able to pass that on to the next generation and also to our own kids, you know, that I'm indebted to, of course, for this wonderful place. And I feel it's a huge blessing to have experienced that and maybe go on to few more times.
I mean, yeah, yes, absolutely. But it's now the Milwaukee Symphony that gets the great benefit of this experience and your benefit of that orchestra's own history. It's a pretty rich culture that they've developed in Milwaukee. And so, nevertheless, it's a different situation from the BSO. And it's not a year-round orchestra, but it's a substantial, you know, subscription season that they do. A really, really important part of that city's life is the Milwaukee Symphony. So tell me, you know, at this point, you have, of course, led concerts there. You've visited there. What is your, how do you describe what the Milwaukee Symphony is right now?
Well, first of all, it is year round except for the summer, you know, so they
used
to have a summer. So it is,
it
is quite, I mean, it's over 40 week season.
Yes, yes.
And they used to have, you know, summer, but, you know, maybe we'll bring it back at some point.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
but
yeah.
It is an extraordinary orchestra and that has had, you know, a history, even though it's much younger than several other orchestras, a major orchestra. And you know, my direct predecessor, of course, is Edo de Waard, And wonderful conductor who has, of course, European tradition. Then you had others, European conductors, including Zdeněk Makal, and before that, Lukas Foss, who brought, of course, a lot of new music and contemporary works. And I got to meet Lukas Foss on a couple of occasions. Because also he worked, of course, with my father. My father performed some of his works in New York.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And at the time I got to meet him. And so, to now continue there and to have been appointed in Milwaukee is great for me, because I feel also culturally there's so many things there that I feel connected to. You know, they have a great background, of course, with the German immigrants there that started what they're celebrating, especially as we speak now, the breweries. You know, the breweries were really started in Milwaukee and the United States. And then you have the dairy farmers, you know, many of them came from Central Europe, you know, started. And then the sausage makers, you know, with all of these old German recipes. So it's very interesting for me to go there. And in fact, last week I actually went to an annual tradition that they have. It's called German Fest, and I couldn't believe how many thousands and thousands of,
a German Fest. I know.
Really, on these stages, I had to see it for myself. You know, they're singing these German songs, and so it's great fun. But it also is a very diverse a city, and
it really
it's growing to be more diverse. And you have many more languages and ethnic minorities, who. Bring in this richness culturally that is growing, and the city and the orchestra with it, is developing in such a way that it has come now for many years. This has been planned, but a very exciting new chapter will start next year, because the new Performing Arts Center will be opened. So we're building one, and we get to open it in the fall if everything goes well. But on track to open this new Performing Arts Center in the fall of 2020. So already next year.
This is, I do know a little bit about Milwaukee, having lived there for a little while, and I haven't been back in a long time, but this development is as important as any new hall, I think, that I've ever sort of known about in any particular, civic life. The location of this new hall is in a place where, when I was living there, was really struggling. It was that particular stretch of town was just kind of at odds with, what was going on. It was very undefined. Nobody could quite figure out what to do with it. And the MSO has taken this and said, this is going to be our center. And it gives the MSO a new chapter of life, because their previous space was a shared space in a compromised hall, because it was an all-purpose performing arts center. So so it does have that stamp of something an orchestra is doing that's very important to the city, beyond even its own audience, I think, right?
Well, yes, and I think so. I think it will become a very important place, and certainly would hope everybody who comes through there, any artists and any orchestra, any audience member, that they will, recognize this and they will have an extraordinary experience and just broadcast that into the world, because I believe it will be quite extraordinary. I mean, I remember the first time that I walked in there with my wife, Melinda, and we were given a tour, we had to wear the hard hats and things, but we walked in there and my jaw just dropped. And I thought, my goodness, because from the outside, you wouldn't know it. From the outside, it looks like an old warehouse that you have to tear down. And why hasn't it been done? Just get rid of this and then build something completely new. And you walk in through the side door, which was the only access point at the time. And literally, it was the most stunning thing that I had, I wasn't expected to see sort of this. And of course, that moment when you discover and when you want to share this moment with people, you've got to see this and you've got to, of course, hear. We hope that it will be as good as everybody says it will be. And, after the tests and the renderings and so on.
Yeah.
And I've now been in the space, several times, and, you're always drawn back. So we certainly want to keep up this atmosphere, this spirit, of what it has had from the old world, because it was a building that was opened in 1930. Can you believe it was started? The building was started, you know, during the Great Depression, you know, and the crash in 1929. And so this is an extraordinary part of history. And as you said, the location, first of all, I mean, Milwaukee being just, you know, an hour and a little bit north of Chicago on the lake with this extraordinary view. And then we're only a few blocks away from the lake, which has seen a beautiful development also, you know, with the art museum by Calatrava and the discovery centers and the beaches. And so this is certainly, you know, the most beautiful city I'd never knew anything about, if you will.
You know, you've encapsulated what a lot of people experience when they show up in Milwaukee. It really is that a place that that you might not really consider until you show up there, and it turns out to be just a wonderful city.
A gem.
Yeah. Artistically, I don't know where the MSO is with what they've been, you know, I haven't kept in touch too much with their artistic projects, but specifically, what do you feel like you're taking from your experience as a member of the Boston Symphony family that you can apply to the MSO and an artistic direction and a way of shaping the next chapter of their identity? What is it you want to do?
The musicians are extraordinary. I have to say, you know, the very first program that I conducted there, it was such a widespread of things, you know, from Daphnis, Chloe Sweet, you know, Vaughan Williams, Flo Scampi, Copeland, Clarinet Concerto, and, you know, and then a new piece that I brought by Augusta Reed Thomas, actually. So there was a huge range in this program with, you know, soloists from the orchestra, with the chorus for Daphnis, and so it was a real splash into, you know, the ocean with them in terms of the range, and also being able to see what this orchestra and this chorus can do. And they're absolutely, you know, there's no limitations, and this is what we feel, of course, here in Boston, with the range of things that one can do. And I felt that they can do that. There are no limitations, you know, in terms of the style, in terms of the range from new to old. And it's such a capable and malleable orchestra. And in fact, many of the new members I knew because they're former TMC fellows. So they've come through here. In terms of the programming, you know, I look forward to it because the my artistic partners there are great. You know, we have some great visions for moving into the new hall, of course, but also of taking the expectations of the city and of the audiences. At the same time, being able to create new waves, if you will, and introduce new sounds and new formats. And doing that next season, which will be my inaugural season starting in September, of course. And so for almost every program that I'm conducting next season, there is a contemporary work on the program. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I had a wonderful conversation about a piece we're doing with a composer who was also in residence here at Tanglewood this summer, Detlef Glanert, fellow German countryman from Hamburg.
Yeah, had a trumpet concerto
for Tom Rolfs.
Yeah, I saw the music for that, and I kind of couldn't believe it.
it was extraordinary. It's a great piece. And so Detlef and I, we sat down together and talked about, because I'm doing his Brahms Fantasy on the opening program.
Nice.
There and you know, that connection. And so, you know, from that going forward, you know, we have pieces of contemporary composers everywhere, just to kind of introduce, you know, this side both of what I find is important to keep as a relationship, but also moving ahead, you know, into the new space, which should always be a place where you celebrate the coexistence of honoring and respecting and celebrating your heritage, mm-hmm. and then of making sure that you support and you encourage new voices, and perhaps even those that, you know, might not have an opportunity otherwise. So that is important, and that's part of the mission, and they will go along, I'm sure, very well. To close out the program, for instance, so we have, you know, Glanert in the beginning, and to close out the season, we're doing a piece by Helen Grime.
Oh, really?
Who also had, of course, a commission this summer here.
Yep.
And Helen, a wonderful composer, of course, and she wrote this beautiful piece called Everyone Sang. And so Everyone Sang we're using for the orchestra, and then we're actually ending the program, you know, with the Dvorak Te Deum, which brings us back to this week.
Yeah, that's right.
So there's just this big arch of the season that will introduce a few new things that will also keep, let's say, the audience understanding that, you know, the flexibility of coming to with flexibility and expectation, that we will be committed to, you know, always giving them, doesn't matter if it's in the Boston Symphony or any other orchestra, of giving people an extraordinarily profound time, you know, where they will love the music, and even if they don't love it, they will love the experience coming out different from on the other side, you know, having gone through it, different people. So I think that in Milwaukee we can do a lot of that. The audience is different. We want to develop the audience there as well, and you know, do reach, you know, outreach and things like that as much, because whenever you have a new building and whenever you have a new performing arts center, it's not about getting people there necessarily, but it's that being the not the destination, but the starting point. Mm-hmm. Of what you can do with the rest of the city, which is quite, you know, large and, you know, quite drawn out. So I look forward to that very much. And the kinds of things that, you know, I was able to do here with, you know, let's say things like Grieg Peer Gynt, the new productions.
Yeah.
Those are perfect for you know, Milwaukee audiences.
Absolutely.
You know, playful, great music, you know, including some actors and maybe even bring some visuals.
Yeah.
And I am absolutely sure they will love that. And this is the kind of programming that we can bring there. But programming that ultimately they will understand you don't have to be afraid of.
Yeah.
You don't have to be afraid of anything, because we will help you along.
Yeah.
We'll take you along. So that, you know, this is what I was grateful to have experienced here with the Boston Symphony. You know, to delve into some major things and major productions, and to see, of course, how these things can be realized that well. And I do believe that we can realize them there as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Ken, it's a terrifically exciting moment. I mean, you know, to take on a new position where you're going to be the person, you're going to be the one that's really driving the bus here, if you can put it that way. And so I know you've done that in other situations, but this is a big step. So congratulations, and I wish you just great things, you know, in Milwaukee. I'm really looking forward to seeing how that comes along. Thanks for
thanks, Brian. You're always invited. Come by.
I would love to come by.
Bring some friends.
Definitely, definitely. It doesn't take much to get me back to Milwaukee. I love the place, so that's great. Thanks a lot, Ken. I appreciate it.
Thank you.